Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 9th of November. The world's oldest and most complete skeleton of a potential human ancestor named Artie was unveiled recently by an international team of 47 researchers. This was a 17-year investigation, and we're going to be talking about it this hour of the program. This, of course, makes Artie, who was discovered in Ethiopia 4.4 million years ago, over a million years older than the famous Lucy fossil, which was found in the same region 35 years ago. Jamie Shreve is the science editor at National Geographic magazine. Before joining the magazine's staff, he was a freelance science writer and author. His books include The Genome War, The Neanderthal Enigma, Solving the Mystery of Modern Human Origins, Lucy's Child, The Discovery of a Human Ancestor, and Nature, The Other Earthlings, the companion volume to the public television series. He is with us to talk about Artie, and we'll be welcoming phone calls, of course, as well. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hi, Jamie. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. So how big, what is the significance of this? I kept hearing this is such a huge, huge discovery. Why was it so big?
Well, it's a fantastic discovery because, unlike Lucy, where we had a very old ancestor that was already fully bipedal, was already walking on two legs, pretty much like we walk on two legs, this new find, Ardipithecus ramidus, or Artie for short, was in transition. It's actually sort of halfway. It's like an ape caught in the act of becoming human. So it walked on two legs on the ground, but was still living much of its life in the trees and walking on four legs.
Hmm. Just like I wish we could do, don't you?
Oh, it'd be great, yeah. But, you know, you can't have everything. And in some sense, you know, once you're committed to bipedalism like we are, you have a suite of other opportunities. Your hands are free, basically, so you can do all kinds of things. And Ardipithecus was much too early to be using tools and making tools like we find later in the hominid fossil record.
Huh. But Ardipithecus was using, I've read somewhere, maybe you disagree, branches, et cetera, for certain things?
Oh, yeah. Well, branches, we're not really sure how it employed objects, you know, but it was probably quite capable because of the design of its hand to be extracting tubers and snapping off things and chasing small mammals and doing fairly complex activities with its hands, but more importantly in some ways is the way that the hands tell us it was getting about in the trees. It had tremendously flexible wrists and hands. If you can imagine taking your own hand and bending it backward as far as it go, and then go another 45 degrees back, that it had the ability to do that because it needed to be grabbing onto branches and holding onto them as it stepped forward, sort of this sort of careful climbing through the trees.
Hmm.
So it was a fairly large-bodied animal, 50 kilograms, and if it fell, that was it. It would die. So it had to have a way of being safe in the trees.
Right. And the reason that it was walking was, or she was walking, was what? What was the advantage of being able to walk? When you were in a forest, they thought that she was in a desert, but she was in a forest.
Well, it's a puzzle. It's a mystery still why she started walking on two legs on the ground. Now, the forest, it wasn't a closed, dense forest. It was a woodland. But there's a lot of apes back earlier in time that were getting by on the ground just fine on four legs. And as you probably know, a chimpanzee or a gorilla, when it's walking on the ground, has a very different kind of locomotion. It uses four legs, and it walks on its knuckles in the front. Artie wasn't doing this. Why it stood up, it's a kind of a mystery. A lot of people thought it had to do with we stood up when we went out on the savanna so we could chase animals better or see over tall grass or something like that. But with this, there was no savanna at this place. So there's a theory we can get into a bit by a guy named Rowan Lovejoy, one of the team members who found the fossils, which basically thinks that he thinks that bipedalism arose as part of a sex contract, food for sex. Basically, the males were standing up and were able to carry food back to a targeted partner, female partner, in return for exclusive sex. Basically, a pair bond like we have today. But that's a very controversial theory.
Huh, isn't that something? Food for sex. And before that, it was.
Well, before that, you'd have maybe something more analogous to a chimp situation, where you could have group huntings going on, and maybe some little bit of sharing. But mostly, you know, individuals ate what they found. They, you know, went out and they foraged together, and females would grab some tubers and fruit and eat them, and so would the males. But nobody was sharing on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. So this way, the guy would bring the female, Artie, some food, and then they would, she would think it was so wonderful that she couldn't say it to him, but she'd say, let's get married and I'll be faithful to you forever.
Well, yeah, that's basically the idea. There's two clues that Dr. Lovejoy uses to support this theory. First, the fact that for no particular other reason that we can define, the creature starts walking on two legs, freeing up its hands. And the hands would then be free to carry things back to another location. So why are you carrying things back to another location if not to provide it to somebody else? The other clue is actually in the teeth. The canine teeth of Ardipithecus are quite small. They're compared to other apes, and certainly compared to modern chimps and gorillas. Living apes have tremendously large canine teeth in the males, which are weapons, right? You know, they're mm-hmm. for fighting off other males. And what are you fighting off other males for? Well, you're fighting off the other male for access to the female often. So if you can imagine a kind of wimpy little small canine male who is able to figure out another way of getting access to females by saying, well, look, I'm not going to fight for you, but look, if you're going to stick with me, I'll bring you food. and then her part of the bargain is, okay, well, I'll stick with you and not go with him if you keep bringing me the food. There's other parts of this theory that get a little complicated, but very intriguing, but maybe we could go into them later if you want.
We'll do just that. You know, as you were speaking, I was thinking about modern male and female relationships, and you sort of have both at work still, don't you? You bring me the food, and you're nice to me, and I love you. I don't care if you're small or big, and then the other side is, you know, the tougher you are, the more I'm going to be attracted to you because it's in my genes, right? It's in the human genetic code.
Pretty much. This is all done unconsciously. Yeah. This,
right.
This would be part of what we used to call instinct. Instinctive behavior on their part. There's the other key part of this equation, which is you have to imagine that the female, well, let's say she's made this contract and she says that she's saying not verbally, but she's making a contract with a small canine male. All right, you go find food for me and you can I'll have sex just with you. Well, he goes off, and why doesn't she just have sex with the big fancy male who's the big a leader of the tribe, and then she can have his genes for her baby, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the way they get around that is she doesn't really know when she's fertile.
Right.
See, if in apes, it's very clear when the female is fertile because they advertise it with elaborate swelling of genitals.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, in humans, it's concealed. So you don't. It's female's always fertile. So she knows that she's never, I mean, she doesn't know when she's fertile, so she always has to stay with the one guy.
Hmm. Interesting. The process of finding Artie was so arduous. I was fascinated to find out that these bones were really in area, they were almost like dust, so they had to be incredibly careful when they were putting her together and getting her out of the ground.
Oh, it was a fantastic piece of science, and that's one of the great stories of this find, not just what she is, but how she was found. Tim White and he's the lead scientist, one of the lead scientists, and his crew are famous for how meticulous they do things. He's very demanding. And this particular fossil, just the fact that it existed at all was amazing. The fact that they stumbled across it was doubly amazing. But then the fact that it was, if you touched it, it would turn to dust. So they had to figure out how to preserve it in the field using glue and then wrapping it in plaster and taking the plaster back to the lab and, you know, month after month, just using dental picks and porcupine quills under a microscope, chipping off the rock around these fossils without actually damaging the fossil. Very, very difficult.
Yeah.
A long time.
Right. It was a long time. She was discovered, what, was she discovered in 94?
The skeleton, yes, was first found in 1994. And as you can imagine, the paleoanthropological community was very anxious to find out what the skeleton was about because everybody knew that Tim and his colleagues had found it, but they didn't know what it meant. So there was a lot of growing impatience, we should say, about the delay and the length of time it took to get it out of the ground. But after the publication last month and people understood why it took so long, I think all that impatience and irritation has gone away.
Right. If she were smiling, according to the drawings that have been made from the bones, she strikes me as being kind of cute, don't you think?
Yeah. I haven't really thought of it that way, but I think she has an appealing, sort of appealing, fuzzy look about her.
An appealing, fuzzy look.
Yeah.
She does indeed.
Yeah, the artist who did those drawings, a guy named Jay Maternus, is the doyen of paleo artists, and it did a marvelous job, and took him many, many years to do this.
Hmm. What Artie tells us about you, right, in your piece in National Geographic News, was this vast intermediate stage in our evolution that nobody knew about. That's big.
That's the huge part. We had sort of an idea of two phases of human evolution. There was the phase of Lucy, Australopithecus, we call that, a creature that was fully bipedal, walking on two legs, but had very small brains and still had a long way to go before it would be something you'd call human. And then we have, of course, Homo itself. Homo habilis was an early form of human, or Homo erectus, or Homo neanderthalis, other members of our genus who had much larger brains and were using tools and had all kinds of more complex behaviors. But we didn't know about this even earlier phase, which is this truly transitional phase from a very, very primitive ape, where you have behaviors where you kind of almost schizophrenic. It's got a foot that's both capable of walking on the ground bipedally and also wrapping its toe around a tree branch like a chimp. So you can see, or somewhat like a chimp, you can see why it's so important. It catches this moment where an ape is becoming a human.
Right. And why would it be evolutionarily important for us to lose the ability to climb in trees?
Good question. I suppose if you had your druthers, you'd be able to do it all.
Yes.
But every time that you make a evolutionary step in a particular direction, you lose something else. And whatever the pressure on this creature to adapt to its environment was greater in the direction of upright walking. So, for instance, I mean, the hand is probably very important because of this ability to manipulate things later on. So that became much more important than that flexible wrist I told you about grabbing that was able to hold on to tree branches. And ultimately, it just became possible to discard those other adaptations for arboreal locomotion without going extinct.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And the other thing that I've been reading, and that you write about this too, is that we're seeing a break from chimp evolution and human evolution earlier than we, well, what's the significance of that when it comes to Artie?
Yeah, this is another big, big surprise about Artie. Everybody's been thinking, and for good reason, that as we go deeper and deeper in time and approach that last ancestor that we shared with chimpanzees, that the creatures would look more and more like chimpanzees, when in fact, Artie shows something quite different. Artie is really nothing like a chimpanzee in his locomotion. I mentioned before the knuckle walking of chimps and gorillas. A lot of people thought that our ancestors must have gone through a knuckle walking phase in order to get upright eventually like we are. And Artie shows that that didn't happen. Artie shows that basically the chimps and the gorillas were developing their own evolutionary trajectory through time, which was quite different. This does not mean that, you know, we didn't come from apes because we don't look like chimps. It means that we didn't come from an ape that looked like a chimpanzee, like a modern ape.
Right. Let's welcome phone calls for Jamie. Our number is 800-486-8655. As Jamie wrote in National Geographic News on October 1st, scientists on that day announced the discovery of the oldest fossil skeleton of a human ancestor. The find reveals that our forebears underwent a previously unknown stage of evolution more than a million years before Lucy, the iconic early human ancestor specimen that walked the Earth 3.2 million years ago. The centerpiece of a treasure trove of new fossils, the skeleton belonged to a small-brained, 110-pound female named Artie. And we're talking about Artie this hour. Here's how you reach us. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And the email address is talk@wpr.org. And so that's that. And our guest is Jamie Shreve, science editor at National Geographic Magazine. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Jamie, starting with June from Shawano. Hi, June.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Hello to your guest.
Hi.
My question is about the dating of Artie. I saw the program on how all of this was done, and I realize how it was done, but I'm a little confused. Would you explain that?
How the dating is done?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Artie was very fortunate, at least the scientists were very fortunate, that the bones were found right between two volcanic layers of ash. Two separate volcanic explosions had occurred. And scientists for a long time now, since the early 60s, have been able to use the crystals in volcanic ash to date the age of when that explosion occurred. Basically, there's an element called argon, and its radioactive type sort of gradually decays through time, and we can measure the rate of that decay and see how long it was ago that explosion happened. So now, since we had this sort of time sandwich, not just one layer of ash, but two, we knew exactly when Artie lived, too, because those two ash layers occurred very close together in time, pretty much within 100,000 years. So we have a time bracket there for Artie at 4.4 million years. I hope that helps.
Thank you very much. It does.
Thanks, June. And when she used the word dating, it made me think about dating. And I'm wondering if you had to bring, if you were the male here, a sufficient amount of food, or she would date others to see if they might bring her more?
It's a good question. And, of course, these are very profound changes in behavior that occurred 4.5 million years ago. It's very hard to know exactly how they happened and what was the process of the sort of the dynamic of that change, but somehow, according to Owen Lovejoy, at least we got from a situation where apes were basically just feeding on their own, and the females were you know, grabbing fruit off the branch just like the males, or maybe grabbing a little baboon if they could get some meat at some point, to a situation where males were providing females, targeted females, a particular female, with nutrition, her and her children, which, of course, would be his children if everything's going well. Yeah. But I don't know whether, you know, there might have been a time where maybe the female was being supplied by more than one male. Mm-hmm. And there was some kind of aggression going on between those males before, you know, this whole new evolutionary scenario sort of settled in. And again, I'd like to point out that this is just, you know, Dr. Lovejoy's theory. He's a very smart man, and he's one of the primary anatomists on this team. But his only that's a theory. That's
right.
As opposed to the bones, where we can look at the bones and see how they're shaped and make inferences about how they were walking.
It was so long ago, wasn't it, Jamie?
It's impossible to comprehend that length of time in when we're thinking about human lifespans or generations, or even thinking back to in terms of an historical point of view, where you're trying to imagine what was like for the Egyptians, you know, 3,000 years ago building the pyramids. I mean, you try to imagine 3,000 years is that would have been like you know, one afternoon in the life of Artie, you know, if you extended it out. It's just
right.
So long ago.
We go next to Valerie from Milwaukee. Hi, Valerie.
Hello there.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm on a cell phone. I hope it'll be okay. I just wanted to comment on that your guest was talking about connection between males bringing food and females being, you know, faithful to him and not going with somebody else, and this whole idea of this complex social relationship. And I've read books. I read a book called When God Was a Woman by Merlin Stone, and it talks about the history when human beings really didn't know where babies came from, and that women were worshipped because they were fertile and they produced children. And then after a period of time, the connection started to happen. And so I think that the conjecture that there was this complex idea of sexuality being connected is just a far-fetched. It's a little giving them a little too much credit to their intelligence.
Well, that's a good point. Though you don't necessarily, these things would not necessarily be consciously, wouldn't be necessarily be conscious behaviors that required a lot of intelligence. I mean, if you think about many bird species are pair bonded, and the male, or in some cases the female, will be the primary food provider for the chicks in the nest. While one of the partners is sitting on the nest, the other is going out there and bringing back food. And it's not because of any sort of thing they've figured out. It's just that's the way that they have evolved to behave. So I think that this notion of this food for sex contract, very, very deep in time in our own lineage, doesn't necessarily require the kind of foresight that you're thinking it might. And it also doesn't necessarily preclude later in time, perhaps, a worshiping of the fertility of the female. You know, that
mm-hmm.
might be something part of it too. I don't know. It's not part of this particular theory, but it doesn't mean it didn't happen.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it sounds like if we're talking about it purely on instinct, but I think we should be careful to not contribute too much thought process.
Absolutely.
Then when we're trying to talk about it.
I agree, and I hope
just
I didn't
my comment
that way. Thanks.
Thanks, Hillary.
Thanks for taking. Bye bye.
Yeah. Bye, Claire from Cedarburg. Hi.
Hi. Good morning.
Hi.
I'd like to just put in a segment about the whole order of primates and how ancient that is. They've just discovered a 47-million-year-old primate that's more like a lemur, like the lemurs that live in Madagascar.
Yes.
And how those led to the sort of ape-like creatures, although that's not all sorted out. But how long this transition is, it's not just 4 million years, it's more like 50 million.
Oh, absolutely. And you're absolutely correct, too, that it's not all sorted out. primate that you're referring to is the so-called link that was announced earlier this year. It's a 37-million-year-old Eocene primate that was originally thought to be on the lineage leading eventually to us and many, many other higher monkeys and apes. But now, as you pointed out, has been shifted over onto the lemur lineage. In other words, it broke off way back in time from anything that would become anything like a human or an ape. So there's the primates are a very complex world that evolved many different types over a vast period of time, some 50 million years. And only one of these lineages, of course, eventually became the one that's kind of pretty much dominant now.
And how did we discover something that was 37 million years old?
Well, it's the same kind of dating techniques that are used at this 4 million year point. There's geological exposures. I think that's a German find, but I'm not sure. But there's geological exposures all over the world where rocks that were originally laid down many, many millions of years ago have been brought back up to the surface either through erosion or through some tectonic activity of earthquakes and faulting. So a little piece of time that was buried long ago is suddenly thrust back up into the present. And with it, all the fossils that, by circumstance, were buried at that time as well. So we have fossils, for instance, the dinosaurs, going much further back than the primates. Wherever you can, once a bone turns to stone, it's pretty much a permanent object. It's just a matter of bringing it back to the surface and having the good fortune to find it.
Yeah. Somebody said about the Ardi finding, and I just happened to be, you may be looking in a certain area, but to be able to find out of all the land surrounding the area, this one incredibly important find is, as somebody said, against all odds. There it is. It's just, it's almost meant to be.
It is truly extraordinary because the deeper you go in time, especially when you're talking about human ancestors, what we call hominids, the deeper you go in time, the rarer they were. They just weren't that common to begin with. And also, the deeper in time you go, the more likely they would have been living in forested environments. And the trouble with forested environments is the nature of the soil in forests and the moisture doesn't preserve bone very well. It doesn't turn bone into fossil. Instead, it just disintegrates.
Oh.
So it becomes much harder to find fossils that are in these more woodland contexts like Ardi was.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to an email. Chuck from Green Bay. This, of course, would be the subject of a whole course and then some, but take on as much as you'd like. Just as humans have evolved, so have chimps. We tend to compare early humans to present-day chimps. What did early chimps look like, and how have they evolved?
That's an absolutely fascinating question. I really admire your correspondent there for asking that. But because we don't know, we really don't know much about the chimp lineages. We know far less about the evolution of chimpanzees than we do about the evolution of humans. And the reason it goes back to what I just said about living in forested environments. Chimps and gorillas have lived in forests, or mostly in forests, there are some on the savannah, but mostly in forests through all of their evolutionary history. So their bones are far less likely to be preserved, and we just don't find that many of them. Now, what we do know, absolutely, both through molecular evidence and just the paleontological record, we do know that eventually the lineage that led to chimps and the lineage that led to us are united at a point in time in the past at a creature we call the last common ancestor. Might have used to be called the missing link, but that term is not very, it's not a good term to use for a number of reasons. But this last common ancestor was something that gave birth both to us and to chimps. And the best possible evidence we have now of what that ancestor looked like is, in fact, Ardipithecus.
Oh.
So if you want information about what chimps look like in the deep past, you also look at Ardipithecus.
Huh.
Because it has these traits that are very, very primitive. There are traits from apes that were living even before this last common ancestor, and therefore were the ancestors of chimps as well as us. So, for instance, these very flexible wrists I mentioned earlier in the program. The other problem is, well, what we really need, you see, is more of these apes that lived in Africa just before this last common ancestor. These Miocene apes that would have been living, say, 12 or 10 million years ago. That's the fossils we need to know both more about our evolution and the chimps, and we just don't have them yet. They're just not that many of them.
Mm-hmm. And where are we looking for them, Jamie?
Well, they're looking in the Western Rift Valleys in Uganda, I think, and in Kenya. There's some sites that are very old. in southern Ethiopia, there's a site that's yielded a very early gorilla form, but it's, you know, just a tooth or two. Still very fragmentary stuff. We haven't anything even approaching what we have for the hominid fossil record later.
We are welcoming phone calls. We have some lines open now as we talk about Ardi this hour of the program. Jamie Shreve is the science editor at National Geographic Magazine and has written extensively about Ardi and also has written books, The Discovery, Lucy's Child, The Discovery of a Human Ancestor, which he wrote in 1989, Nature, the Other Earthlings, 1987. He is also author of The Genome War and The Neanderthal Enigma, Solving the Mystery of Modern Human Origins. Our phone number, lines are open for him right now, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about Ardi this hour of the program. Fascinating to learn about Ardi. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. I want to talk, Jamie, just a little bit about how Ardi looks, because as one of the professors who commented on this finding said, and it is so true, it seems that the last common ancestor of chimpanzees and humans was much less chimpanzee-like than previously thought. So the anatomy of closely related living species cannot predict the anatomy of their ancestors very accurately. How true that is from looking at pictures of Ardi.
Yeah, I think so. Although just a cursory glance, you might think, well, this looks like an ape to me because it's got that fuzzy look and that's this sort of short snout of a chimp, and it has a very small brain and brow ridges a little bit bigger than ours, so that it has a generally sort of apish look, but very different than a chimp.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, mostly in its skeleton below the neck, you can see that it's not built at all for this knuckle walking activity or for climbing vertically up tree limbs.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's a different machine, evolutionary machine.
Right. And this same anthropologist who said that also said that it's certain to cause rethinking of not only our evolutionary past, but also that of our living relatives, the great apes. And so I ask you, how so?
Well, we've often used the great apes as an analogy for trying to understand early human behaviors as well as anatomy. And there's a good reason why we do that. There's nothing else around. I mean, if you're trying to find information about something that happened 4 million years ago, and you take in whatever evidence you possibly can. So we look at, we've looked at chimpanzees' social behavior, their tool use, their means of extracting food from their environment, their intelligence and degree of cognitive ability, and we've made inferences about that backwards in time to early humans. And what this fossil seems to suggest, this is certainly controversial, is that you really can't make those inferences anymore. You really can't look at a chimp and say, oh, look at the way that it's using a stick to get termites out of a nest. Aha! Early humans must have done something similar. Because, you know, they were on their own path, the chimps, and they've stayed on their own path. And actually, as you can see, they haven't exactly flourished. The other ape lineages, other than us, other than the hominid lineage, have not been particularly successful. They don't occupy huge geographic territories.
Right.
They're isolated in particular environments, mm-hmm. by and large. So they've certainly obviously managed to survive and continue for millions and millions of years, but they don't have the kind of ubiquitous reach that our own lineage had long before we developed things like, you know, airplanes and cars. We got all across the globe walking on two legs.
Mm-hmm. Mike from Madison, hi.
Hi, I had a quick question. Actually, two quick questions. One, the first one was regarding the wrist bone. From my understanding, the special, there was a specific one bone in all the bones that was in the wrist that was really important to the discovery that showed it being able to walk upright as well as on all fours. And my question is, had that specific one little bone not been found, how much of a difference would that have made? And so, on the other, like Lucy and other species that were found, do they have a similar bone in the wrist, or is it just slightly enough different? And then the third question is, at what point in the history of the find and aging process, where does this Arthropodicus fall? Is this before or after Adam and Eve? And I'll take my comment off the air. Thanks.
Okay. Well, those are three questions, two related and one not as related. Let's take the first set, too. I think the little bone that you're referring to is a bone called something like the os peronum. I may not be pronouncing that correctly. But it was not in the... If it's the one I think that you're referring to, it's not in the hand, it's in the foot. And it is a tiny bone, and it did make a big difference in the interpretation. And that just goes to the point of how important it is to really scour these discovery sites for every possible scrap of information, which this team did, and once is one of the reasons it takes 15 years to do something like this. That little bone changes the orientation of a tendon, and it makes it creates a different relationship between the big toe and the rest of the foot, which is more human-like, and you find this only in Ardi, and you don't find it in chimps. So that was a very important thing. If they hadn't found it, yes, you're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. Their argument might have been quite a bit weaker, mm-hmm. than it was. The second question on Adam and Eve is something that I think everybody has to decide on their own, where to relate the religious world to the scientific world. I'm a science editor at a magazine that, you know, is devoted to believing in the process of evolution, and I don't myself need to relate this to Adam and Eve, but others might, and it's a question that regards everybody has to take seriously and deeply and look at it for themselves.
Thanks for the call, Mike. We go to Mark next from Brookfield. Hi, Mark.
Hello. I was watching a special on Ardi on the Discovery Channel, and I cannot remember the specifics, but the scientists there came up with the conclusion that humans actually descended from a primate different from chimpanzees based on DNA evidence. And your guest had just said that they had a common ancestor, so I just wanted to get a clarification on that.
Okay, that's a good time to clarify this. The Discovery Channel show, based, of course, on the same research that our articles in National Geographic and on the web are based on, and they say the same thing. The evidence shows that both chimpanzees and humans came from a common ancestor. It's just that that common ancestor was not like a chimp any more than it was like a human being. Both human beings and chimpanzees have been evolving a long time for, you know, all those periods of years in their own separate directions. So you have to sort of run the reel backwards in time and watch it. If you can imagine a movie going backwards to its very beginning, you see the point where that split happened, and that creature, that last common ancestor, does not look like a chimp. Doesn't look like a human either. It looks like a very primitive kind of ape that was more primitive than either one of those two things we see today. I hope that clarifies things. It's an important point, and I know it's a little hard to get across.
I'm sorry, Mark. We missed the whole first part of that. What were you saying?
I see what you're saying, that the basically the point is that humans are not descended from chimpanzees, that they're both descended from something much older.
That's correct. Absolutely.
That's it. Thanks very much for the call. Do we know, could scientists determine how old Artie was when she died and how she died?
That's a good question, too. I think she's thought to be a young female adult based on the degree of tooth wear and other clues like that, but I'd have to actually, you know, check my notes to be sure of that. But I believe she was a young female.
Mm-hmm. And somewhere I read, is this part of your understanding too, that she was pushed down in the ground? The bones were by hippos that were running over that area.
Well, she died. We know that much for certain, that she died. And unlike almost everything else, and I forgot to mention this earlier when we were talking about just the sheer wonder that this thing was found. Most of the things that die in those environments are torn apart after death by carnivores, by scavengers,
sure,
like hyenas. And so most of the bones you find in this area of this place called the Middle Awash at that age are just absolutely riddled with chopped up and gouged marks from these hyenas, if they're found at all. And here was Artie without a scratch.
She had no evidence
that she'd been scavenged by hyenas after she died.
Huh.
So the inference is that she must have died in some sort of hidden area, maybe like under some bushes near a stream where she could be rapidly covered up, and then her bones were later pushed down into the mud by passing hippos or other big herbivores, and thus, you know, further protected from hyenas, so that fairly quickly, for whatever circumstance, she got buried where she was safe from damage from the environment above, including the carnivores.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
And there were other bones found. You couldn't put them together as you could to determine that there was an Artie, but there were other bones of humanoids also discovered in this area?
Oh, yeah. This is very important, that this wasn't just the one skeleton. One skeleton will tell you a whole lot, but it won't tell you about the relationships between various animals. You know, so in addition to the partial skeleton that we call Artie, there were some 36 other Ardipithecus specimens found, far less complete. But it gave us can tell us a lot more if you have many individuals. For instance, that business I talked about, large canine teeth. We know that Ardipithecus had small canine teeth, not just from one skeleton, but because if we have a whole selection of canine teeth, and all of them are small. So it's not just that this one person happened to have, or one creature happened to have little teeth. It's that we can see that both the males and the females all had reduced canines. So that's an important point. In addition to the hominid bones, there was 6,000 other bones found.
Goodness.
Of all kinds of creatures, everything from hippos down to dung beetles, or at least dung beetle droppings were found, and little tiny insects, and pollen grains, and everything you could possibly imagine to help recreate the environment that this hominid was living in. Very important to get that kind of broad ecological context. That's how, for instance, we know that it was living in a woodland. We have figs, fig seeds preserved,
Oh, it's so fascinating, all of it, isn't it?
Yep.
Just something. Chris from River Hills, hi.
I've noticed something in biological evolution, and I can explain it, but I would like to know the formal name for this. I can only give you a flawed analogy. Suppose I live in Wyoming.
Probably give you a flawed answer, but I'll try.
Okay. Suppose I live in Wyoming. There's no mass transit.
Okay.
I construct a crude automobile. Once I use that to get food, that's a pretty obvious use. That was my motivation. I either construct a crude automobile or I starve. Okay. After I've constructed the automobile, I now have the ability to drive to an auto repair store, buy automobile parts, buy gasoline, and so forth. Suddenly, I've got some second function there, and I've got an interaction with my environment that builds on itself. I can now put new tires on and so forth. What do we call this? Do we call this a positive feedback loop? And I'm sorry this is such a bad analogy. I could give you a second example involving speech and a human being and the upper body mass. I've heard this explained. But the idea is that there's something going on dynamic, some interaction with the organism and the outer environment, and it feeds back on itself.
Uh-huh.
But go ahead.
There is a term called an exaptation, as opposed to an adaptation, or there's some term called a pre-adaptation. And it might be something that sort of like what you're referring to. Just correct me if I'm off here, but... Take, for instance, feathers evolving on a dinosaur or an early bird ancestor of some kind. The reason for feathers might have been to protect the chick in the nest. It's a sort of keep it warm. It's a thermoregulation device, right? It has nothing to do with flying, right? But once you have the feathers, they become some equipment that you can then use for an entirely different purpose that was not intended from its original use. So the feathers then become a necessary part of a new adaptation, which is flying, along with other things, hollow bones and changes in the shoulder girdle and so forth. But you've got feathers all of a sudden. Not all of a sudden, probably took millions of years. But the point of it is they weren't originally meant to do what they now do. So it's what we call an exaptation. I don't know if that's exactly what you're looking
at. Thanks very much. I want to get to one more question here. Earlier in the discussion, this is an email, you talked about why Artie may have given up the ability to live in the trees, and you said that sometimes we have to give up something when we are making evolutionary choices. Can you speculate on what evolutionary changes might ensue from our modern lifestyle?
That's a wonderful question.
Isn't it?
Yeah, I probably need to sit down here at my desk and ponder that for a while, but there are things. For a long time, people thought that we've basically stopped evolving. The humans have stopped evolving because we have culture, and culture does a lot of the things that biology used to do for us. For instance, if we want to go live in a very cold environment, we move our population into a frigid area. We don't need to evolve more fur. We just buy a parka, right? We just develop a better way of building houses. So that if you have cultural buffers, then you never have to go any farther. Well, that idea is now being challenged a lot. And there's some ways we can see where culture itself is pushing the direction of human evolution. It's really interesting. We're actually going to have a little story about this in Geographic up the road. For instance, I can think of a good example. C-sections, there are a lot more babies now delivered by cesarean section. It's a simpler process in some ways. If there's any complication, zip, zip, in and out of the doctor's office, the hospital. And that means that babies could be born without the constraints of having to go through the birth canal that mm-hmm. we used to have. So you might have babies that are gradually evolving larger heads, for instance, with bigger brains. Huh. I'm making this up as a speculation, but it's a way you can see where evolution can continue into the future in directions which we cannot really tell from where we are today.
Yeah, and on that note, we're out of time. Jamie,
genetic engineering.
Right, right. Thank you so much for being with us. It was just fascinating.
Well, thanks very much. It was great being on your show, Kathleen.
Jamie Shreve, science editor at National Geographic Magazine, talking about Artie, and he's written quite a bit about Artie. We thank him for being here. Rob Schroeder produced this program. Thank you, Rob. He started his new job today, so we wish him well. Thanks to Katie Mattson for filling in here, and, well, thanks to you for your calls, and you're so smart. It's really great to have somebody like this and have this conversation about the important find of Artie. I guess that's about all I have to say for now. I do want to let you know that we're on Facebook. I should tell you that. If you go to WPR.org and maneuver around, find Kathleen Dunn, and there we are. Thanks for listening. Until tomorrow.